Are vampires misunderstood? Are they really real? Are they from the depths of hell? Are they blood-sucking, soulless creatures? Well, today we are going to talk with author A.P. Sylvia, who has been interested in the supernatural beliefs of vampires and their origins. He has explored the essential text of vampire folklore and has visited various vampire-related locations. We're going to talk about his book, Vampires of Lore: Traits and Modern Misconceptions. A lot to discuss right here on Truth Be Told. I'm Tony Sweet, the host of Truth Be Told. Please welcome to the studio, A.P. Sylvia. There he is. How you doing, sir?
I'm well. Thanks for having me on.
Well, this is an exciting show. We were talking before how folklore I just love. It's interesting to hear all about the subjects of people's legends and mysteries from thousands of years ago, and vampires have been around for a long time. So this is a subject that we've always liked to talk about. And you don't have to wait for Halloween. You can talk about it anytime. So thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. So first of all, we were saying that you're not a vampire, but you're like me. You like the folklore of vampires. So tell us how you got interested in the subject itself.
Yeah. I am not a vampire. I've always been interested in supernatural beliefs and legends and things like that. Ever since I was a kid, I had, books about the supernatural and stuff like that. What really got me interested in vampire folklore and really honed my focus was actually a trip to a Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in Times Square. There's a number of them around. They're a lot of fun. Lots of really cool objects and oddities and things. And while I was there, they had on display this antique looking box filled with vials and a cross and a stake and a mold for silver bullets and whatnot. And it was labeled as a 19th century vampire killing kit that people supposedly would, take with them if they were going to Eastern Europe or something like that.
Right.
And it was a great, great piece, great aesthetic. I really like the look of it. And so afterwards, I was kind of thinking about it again. I was like, oh, what's the story with these kits? What's going on? And so I took to the internet, and I actually found that there was a bit of controversy surrounding them in regards to their authenticity. Some people maintained that the kits were actual pieces from the 1800s. Other people argued that, well, they were actually assembled in the 20th century using pieces from the 1800s. So someone took, an antique box and, an antique cross or something like that, right, and sort of put it all together and labeled it as a vampire killing kit. And one of the arguments for that was that, oh, well, these kits kind of represent our movie vampires and our kind of modern notions about vampires and don't really reflect, the folklore. And that sort of statement, that kind of notion and comparison to sort of the actual beliefs and sort of modern thoughts really got me on a track of like, well, what did people believe about vampires in the past? And I had seen a couple documentaries and things. I knew that there were some differences. But I started looking for like a rundown, like, will someone go through like everything we associate with vampires today? The fangs, the garlic, the bats, all that stuff. And sort of tell me where it came from. And I couldn't find anything like that. So I started sort of researching all these different things, and I ended up writing the book that I wanted to read.
Which is Vampires Lore. Well, because we've been around, I've been on this earth for a while, half a century, and I grew up with, Bela Lugosi. That's the vampire I grew up with, scary and just the mystery of it and the evil part of it. But then the new generation, they got Twilight, which was completely different than the vampires that we grew up with. So the original vampire that I think in Renee in the chat room, thank you, Renee, was Vlad the Impaler. Did you go all the way back and study him also? So how did you get the resources, and how did you compare each vampire in different stages?
Sure. So there's a few things we can kind of unpack there. So a lot of our kind of modern imagery with vampires, alluring vampires or suave, sophisticated vampires. You can think of Bela Lugosi, you know, in his evening attire, right. Hanging out in like a mansion and stuff like that with, you know, a social gathering. A lot of that came about with 19th century fiction. Vampire stories written then kind of took the folkloric belief and kind of turned it into this character that was sort of suave and alluring and mysterious. Yeah, there he is. So that evolved. Obviously Bram Stoker's Dracula was, had a tremendous influence. And then you have the Dracula movies and things like that. And ultimately you wind up with the more modern vampire stories. But again, they're still sort of alluring and interesting and attractive and stuff like that. Folkloric vampires were no one wanted to hang out with a vampire. they were scared. People were quite literally afraid of them. In terms of Vlad the Impaler, a lot of that comes from the ties that were established between Bram Stoker's work and the historical prince Vlad. That is from that's a great movie. What happened with Stoker was Stoker found the name Dracula in a book, and it mentioned that like Dracula meant devil, and it was the name of this ruler from Eastern Europe.
Right.
And so Stoker kind of took that and sort of put that on his vampire character. Vlad the Impaler, he was a prince or a voivode of Wallachia, and in the 1400s he was known to be a very brutal ruler, and it was a brutal time, known for impaling people and things like that. No one during his lifetime thought he was a vampire or anything like that. They knew he was brutal and to be feared and stuff. The vampire?
Yeah, where did they get the vampire?
I think it came from Stoker. I think Stoker was doing research about Eastern Europe, ran across this reference to this prince who fought these wars, who was named Dracula, and ultimately he used that name and kind of made it such that his Count Dracula was this prince. But Stoker, a lot's been kind of hypothesized about what Stoker knew about Vlad's life. I read the work of Dr. Elizabeth Miller, who did quite a bit of research on this. And basically, the only thing that's really known is that he read this like one brief reference about Vlad in this one particular book. And that's the only thing people really know for sure that Stoker knew about Vlad. And it kind of makes sense when you read Dracula. He doesn't say a whole heck of a lot more about Vlad the Impaler. In fact, he didn't even know that his name was Vlad, I don't think. It was just he knew the name Dracula. Vlad was known as Vlad Dracula. His father was Dracul, because his father was part of this order of chivalry, right. The Order of the Dragon. And then so Vlad referred to himself as Dracula, the son of the dragon, but it can also translate to devil, apparently. So in terms of my research and in terms of vampire stories, there's various vampire accounts from different countries and different time periods. In fact, I found stories that related to the undead. They didn't necessarily use the term vampire. Vampire was used in certain places and times. But one story I found was from the 12th century. So that's way before Vlad, and it was from the UK.
I was going to ask you if there was anything before him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's been various kind of stories about the undead, revenants, and stuff like that at various time periods in the past. So it's been something that's been with humanity, this notion, for a very long time.
And how did bats and vampires, is it because, was that just a Hollywood thing that connected bats and vampires together? Because they kind of started dressing and looking like bats.
They do, right? So you think of like a Hollywood movie, or like a Halloween vampire, right? Where they kind of lift their cape up and it's like a bat, like bats. And right. They have kind of pointy ears and things. It's funny because you would think that bats would be very much associated with vampires, right? Because they're these, you know, nocturnal creatures and stuff like that. And, or they're these vampire bats that actually do drink blood and stuff. But actually in folklore, the associations between vampires and bats are very limited, virtually non-existent. People did believe that vampires turned into different kinds of animals, but for some reason, bats was sort of never listed. There were like a couple references to vampires being able to turn into bats, but it's practically non-existent. For a very long time, actually, it was thought that Stoker invented it, and it didn't exist in folklore at all. There were a couple folkloric and literary precedents before Stoker, but it was very limited. So Stoker can't say that he invented it, but he certainly popularized it. People often think that the vampire bat might have influenced the belief about vampires, mm-hmm. but actually vampire bats are only native to the Americas. So they don't exist in Europe, so they wouldn't have influenced that belief in Europe, because Europeans would have encountered vampire bats, like, say, in the 1500s, and it would have taken a while for that knowledge to even kind of disseminate among different people. So really the bat, by and large, is kind of a modern construction.
Well, let me ask you this. The vampire, the word itself... Where did that come from? Was that like Greeks, or I mean, where did that come from?
There's been a few different discussions about the possibilities of that. In fact, there's been some like articles written about the potential origins, the etymology of the word vampire.
It's probably not Greek. I just threw it out there. That's why.
Yeah. one hypothesis was that it was was originated from a Turkish word that meant witch. Yeah, there's actually quite a bit of overlap between beliefs regarding vampires and witches in folklore. We often put kind of like different sorts of supernatural beings and monsters into like boxes in our mind, especially with movies, like, well, this is a vampire and this is what it does, and this is a werewolf and this is what it does, and this is like an evil witch, malevolent witch, this is their powers. But in folklore, these beliefs would often influence other beliefs and kind of evolve and change over time. So you actually have quite a bit of influence there among these different sort of notions around supernatural entities.
Well, let's go over some of the traits of vampires. What is actually constitutes a vampire? What constitutes a vampire? I mean, because like you said, Vlad the Impaler was not a vampire. It's just he got kind of assigned the name. But what actually constitutes it?
Right. Yeah. So Vlad kind of got this association to vampires via Dracula. And, you know, I think forevermore, probably he'll certainly be brought up. So when I started doing my research about vampires, and I was like, well, I want to figure out, well, what did people believe about vampires? The first thing I had to do was actually sort of define, well, what constitutes a vampire? What is a vampire? Because when you start researching these things, there's all kinds of different beliefs, say, like, you know, about monsters and things mm-hmm. that suck blood and whatnot. And I was like, well, you know, that they often get brought up in these discussions, but I'm like, well, is that really a vampire or is that something else?
Right.
You know, and like, what does, you know, how do I need to put some borders around this thing so I can say, okay, this is what people believe. And so I arrived at actually three criteria that I use to define a vampire. Some people might feel it's too narrow, some people might feel it's too broad, but it gave me kind of a direction and a focus when I was doing my research. So the first thing is that the vampire is, it is the corpse of a once living person. So they used to be an actual living person, and they have subsequently died. So right there, I'm kind of discounting like monster, like demons and supernatural beings that were never human to begin with.
Right.
right? Because there's a lot of different legends, you know, that are surrounding, like, you know, these kind of, maybe it's a demon that sucks blood and stuff like that, but it was never human, or it never died, let's say, you know? So that was kind of the first thing, that the vampire was once like a living person who has subsequently died. The next criteria was that the corpse is harming the living in some way. So I actually broaden it out a bit beyond purely blood drinking. Because when you read some of these accounts and stuff like that, sometimes, you know, blood drinking is mentioned. Sometimes it's kind of mentioned in sort of a list of things the vampire is doing. But, you know, to me, if you solely focus on the blood drinking, you might miss out on certain relevant stories. Because a lot of times, really, what it relates to is a fear of the dead and a fear that the dead could cause the living harm. So that was my second criteria. My third was that to destroy the vampire, action has to be taken against the corpse itself. So with this, I'm kind of emphasizing that there is a physicality to vampires. They're not like ghosts or spirits that are kind of untethered in a way, sort of, you know, ethereal or something like that. There's a physicality that there's, you know, when people are sort of believe that they're being plagued by a vampire, they can actually turn their attention to a physical corpse in the ground, in their local graveyard, and they take action against that. So that was to me also an important kind of point of it. So with those three criteria in mind, that's kind of how I define the vampire for my purposes. I think it kind of helped give it direction, but of course, you know, if there's something that's kind of, you know, maybe seems relevant or a little off the beaten path, you know, I'm not scared to go in that direction too, if I think it's fun.
Right. Renee and also in the chat room want to know, do you think Dracula or vampires are demons or devils or just associated with either of the two?
Yeah, so that's interesting. There were, you know, there were different beliefs surrounding kind of what a vampire may or may not be, sort of what was causing it. There were some beliefs that were involved if someone had been evil in life, or if mm-hmm. they had practiced like black magic or something like that, they would become a vampire in death. So in that case, it's more like, you know, the evil of the person was persisting the vampire. There were some that wondered if vampires were caused by the devil or something like that, or even an illusion caused by the devil, let's say. You know, there are even some beliefs surrounding kind of the nature of the soul. There was one belief where it was thought that every person had two souls, one soul that was kind of always in your body and another mm-hmm. soul that would sort of go roaming at night while you dreamt. And if you died while that second soul was off wandering, the soul that was always with you would leave, but then that second soul would come back and then animate your body as a vampire. So there were actually a number of different sort of interpretations of what people thought was going on. And in some cases, I think, you know, the people didn't necessarily have a specific explanation for it. They just thought it was happening and thought that, well, you know, this is something bad. We need to take action.
Well, I want to find out what some of the traits are, and what would be surprising traits of a vampire that isn't present in folklore.
So, you know, the one trait I'll mention. I always feel a little bad saying this because I think it's a bit of a letdown. You know, one thing that is quite iconic to our vampire imagery are the fangs, right? You know, the two extended canines. Right. I mean, even if you're watching like a television show or something like that, and someone looks at the camera menacingly and they smile and they have the two fangs, then you immediately say, oh, that's a vampire, right? They mm-hmm. really don't need to right. do much else. That's the image. And interestingly, in folklore, fangs are not present. It's not mentioned. It's not brought up. going along with that, the two puncture wounds that in the neck that, mm-hmm. you know, when you can tell someone's been the victim of vampire,
right.
that also isn't found in folklore. If a wound on the neck is mentioned, it's singular. It's a wound. They don't mention like the two bite marks. So the fangs aren't present. There are a couple accounts where they mention that the vampire had elongated teeth. And sometimes people might read that and go, oh, they meant fangs. Well, they didn't say fangs. They said teeth, implying all their teeth. You might interpret that, an explanation for that might be that the gums were receding due to decomposition of the body. So, you know, in a number of these vampire accounts, people would actually exhume corpses and examine them looking for like signs of vampirism. And fangs were not in there. They weren't mentioned.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So I want to know, because we were talking earlier, and then that I've interviewed a priest from the Church of Satan before on my show, but I've never actually met someone living as a vampire. Have you ever interviewed or have you ever met living vampires?
I have not. I know that there are communities of people out there that they like, some people like to dress, you know, in sort of what we would associate to be, you know, vampire style, like gothic clothing and kind of, you know, that sort of aesthetic. Right. Some people believe that they need to, you know, like feed on the energy, like the psychic energy of other people. And there are some people who feel that they do need to consume small amounts of blood from willing donors to sort of feel normal or have energy or that kind of thing. I haven't spoken to anybody in those communities. That's not really where my research was. My focus is on sort of the legends and the folklore of the past. So I can't speak to that stuff with much authority again, because I haven't really talked to those people.
Have you noticed, it's almost like, I hate to compare it to Christmas, but Christmas is very similar to me than vampires in this way. The Christmas tree, you know, from Germany, you know, a lot of pagan stuff for Christmas in association with it. And things were just added as the years went on, you know, Christmas tree, Santa Claus, you know, gift giving, all this stuff. With the vampires, did you go back and kind of see when, like, you know, when they added the fangs and when they added the bats and when... Did you see that? Get to see that on paper through your research when they started adding these?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I talk about this sort of thing in my book of, you know, if it wasn't in folklore, when was it introduced? When did this happen? A lot of things. A lot of our modern notions were introduced in 19th century literature. Mm-hmm. That's when you see this kind of pivot in sort of how vampires are represented and how they operate and stuff like that. Now, it's also important to note that, you know, vampire beliefs, you know, vampire folklore is found in various countries and various times. And thus there is variation just because it's, you know, different places, different cultures and stuff like that. But in the 19th century, in literature, fangs are introduced. They're introduced in the 1840s. There's this penny dreadful called Varney the Vampire. And that
Varney?
Is when, yeah, Varney the Vampire.
Oh, Varney. You said, yeah, Varney like the, I love you.
Oh, no, not Varney. Yeah, Varney. Varney with the Vampire. They liked the alliteration, you know, for the title. Right. It was a penny dreadful. It ran for a very long time. It was a serial. Right. And in that, the vampire has fangs, and they talk about the two wounds and stuff like that. And it's compiled into kind of a large novel. But that sort of introduced something. You can imagine how probably fresh that was to readers at the time,
right?
Like now it's a given with vampires, but in that would have been new. So the vampire sort of took on this aristocratic kind of role in the 19th century. You know, before that in folklore, the vampire would have been like a neighbor by and large, right? Mm. It would have been someone in the community. There are a number of instances, documented instances, where people thought one of their neighbors who had died was a vampire. and they actually exhumed the corpse and took action against the corpse and stuff like that. So these were real beliefs. With the 19th century fiction, this is now these are people telling stories, so they're making an interesting story. So in Victorian times, it was probably more compelling for readers that the vampire was moving about in high society and thus was a threat in their homes and their friends and their social circles and stuff like that. You know, you have Bram Stoker, say, popularizing the bat transformations and stuff like that. The shift to kind of the suave vampire really happened more in the early 1800s. It was this novella called The Vampire. And it's about this vampiric character, Lord Ruthven, and he befriends this young man, and they travel together, and the young man kind of realizes that Lord Ruthven has this sort of a negative effect on the people around him. He kind of causes harm and stuff like that, and ultimately he realizes, but at the same time, Ruthven's very, he's a nobleman, he's very alluring, he has this kind of appeal, and ultimately he realizes that Ruthven's a vampire. The novella was written by this guy, Dr. Polidori, who was the personal physician to Lord Byron, the famous poet. And apparently the two men didn't get along, so some people think that Polidori based his Lord Ruthven vampire on Lord Byron. So you could actually, and the vampire novella was quite popular and stuff like that. So it could be this sort of, again, this influence of one author basing this vampire on somebody and changing things about to make it a more interesting read, to make it more relevant to the audience. And now, you know, that sort of evolved and grew over time. And now we are where we are with our expectations about vampires. But the thing I find interesting about vampires today is that there's often a lot of focus put on their immortality, right? That's something I think that appeals to modern audiences. So it's often emphasized in shows and stuff like that, that the vampire can live forever. And sometimes you have people who are seeking out the vampire because they want to live forever and that kind of thing. And I think that sort of speaks to modern audiences, because when you look to the past in vampire folklore, people often, they were using the vampire to explain something that was going on, an illness, death, things of that nature. They needed the vampires as that form of explanation and catharsis. We don't need the vampire for that nowadays, but we still have this fear of aging, growing old, and dying. Science hasn't conquered that. Right. So I think, you know, in vampire stories today, that is a very compelling notion to modern audiences. But at the same time, the modern vampire in these stories is cursed because they have this immortality. And I think that also speaks to us, because, you know, maybe we deep down we know that, you know, the course of nature shouldn't be subverted.
I mean, people ask all the time, do you want to live forever? And I mean, if you could live forever with your loved ones, sure. But if you live forever and everybody that you love is gone, no. I mean, that would be your curse to me, as living way, way beyond your loved ones. So I think that's probably where that is. But one thing you said back, some of the folklorists, they thought some of their neighbors were vampires. It reminds me of the witches of Salem, where a lot of the people thought their neighbors were witches.
Mm.
Did they have accounts like where they would burn, you know, put a stake through the heart? What did they do when they found out, or they thought their neighbors were vampires? Did they do something like the Salem witch trial?
So there are a number of kind of interesting parallels between beliefs in vampires and kind of witch panics, beliefs in malevolent witches, right? So basically in any of these kinds of situations, when you look to the past, people believe that the supernatural had a very kind of real effect on their daily lives.
Right.
Right. So, you know, if something bad happened, if someone was sick or something like that, they didn't have the benefit of our knowledge today. Right. If someone gets sick and then another person gets sick, well, we know about germ theory. We know that people, you know, that disease can be transmitted that way. In times gone by, people didn't understand that. And so they would look for reasons. They try to explain things, and the supernatural would be a way to do it. So with these kinds of things, I mean, basically, in some cases, if there was illness or there was some misfortune befalling a community, suspicion may fall upon the dead. And so now you have vampires. Mm-hmm. But if suspicion falls on the living, well, now you have witch panics, right, and that kind of thing. So it depends on kind of the beliefs of the people at the time in terms of where their suspicion may fall. So in terms of vampires, there are various accounts where they thought that, you know, say there was people in the village who were dying, right? And this has happened in various instances where someone would get sick, someone who maybe seemed healthy or something like that, they'd get sick, pass away, and then another person would get sick and pass away, and then another person sick. And so the people are kind of looking around going, well, what's going on here? What's the origin of this? And sometimes what would happen is they would think, well, this all started when this first person passed away. Maybe there's something there. Maybe that's the root of the problem. Let's dig that body up and let's take a look and see what's going on. So they would do that. And normally when people think about a body decomposing, I think most people even today think about it as, well, you're moving on your way towards being a skeleton. So if you look at sort of a dead body, it should be somewhere between where they were when they died and skeleton. But that is not necessarily what happens. So people would exhume these bodies and they would see things that to them were signs of vampirism. So the body may seem unnaturally preserved. They may look fresh, as if they had as if they were sleeping or if they had just died, even if they had been dead for some months. The body may look like it had gained weight, that they were bloated and that they were red in the face, right? They might look in a way like healthier than they did when they were alive, which again, that can happen during the decomposition process. But these people looking at that didn't understand that. To them, it looked like, oh, well, this person must be feeding on something because they've gained weight in the grave. It might look like they have fresh fingernails or fresh skin and stuff like that. So they would see these signs that looked like it was an unnatural vitality in the grave. And that to them was an indication that something was going on, that this was the root of the problem, that this dead body in the ground was somehow stealing the life of the living and thus preserving its own kind of undead life. So depending on the time and the place, there were different ways to handle this situation. Staking was a well-established way to put an end to the vampire. Burning it, that was often kind of the kind of final way to get rid of it. They would burn the body to ashes. But there might be other approaches. They might cut off the head and stuff like that. A lot of the methods were ways in which, you know, to prevent the corpse from rising again, you would mutilate it in some fashion. Mm-hmm. So it couldn't get back up out of the grave and attack people or preserve itself in some way.
I never understood when they said put a stake through the heart. Well, if you're dead, you probably don't have much of a heart left anyway. So I never understood. What was that legend? Where did that come from?
Yeah, so there's actually a few different interesting things about staking the vampire. In some accounts, when they talk about staking the vampire, they'll actually say that they pinned it to the earth with a stake. In those cases, the stake was actually serving a very practical role. Mm-hmm. They would put the stake through the body into the ground underneath it, so that the body couldn't sit up. It couldn't raise itself up out of the ground. So it was literally pinned into the ground.
Got it.
But the thing is, there's other implications there too. So in terms of the heart, one of the vampiric signs people in some cases, they would actually remove the heart and look for what they thought to be fresh blood in the heart. If there was blood in the heart, they thought that was an indication that it was a vampire. So a stake through the heart, there's also, you know, because the heart is associated to blood and life and stuff like that, there was probably the destruction of the heart also might have played into it. Interestingly, too, with stakes is that, you know, we often think of a wooden stake, you know, that's kind of a nice kind of imagery. But the type of wood used was actually important. So certain beliefs was that it was hawthorn or blackthorn, oak. They thought that the type of wood they used for the stake was important to kill the vampire. The hypothesis there is that they believe that those types of wood, they were used in the crucifixion. So it probably imbued the stake with like a religious power or a religious authority. So the stake is interesting. So it's got these practical implications, but it also has these kinds of supernatural or mystical ones as well.
So why do you think folklore sticks through time? Meaning, unless we, it's kind of like if, like oxygen, we say, you know, oxygen is there, but we don't see it. God is there, but we don't see it. It's same with like Bigfoot and vampires and so many things. You know, a lot of people say they see things, but there's really no proof. How do we know vampires are just a myth? Maybe they are real. I mean, have you met anybody that had an account of a vampire? I know you said you haven't met any, but
so, you know, in terms of vampires and if they're real, personally, based on the research I've done, I'm not yet convinced that corpses are actually clawing their way out of the ground and attacking people. However, you know, it depends on who you ask. In the 2000s, there was actually a story, it made the international news, of a rural community in Romania that thought that they were being plagued by the vampire of someone who had recently deceased in that community. Right. And so they exhumed the corpse and they took action against it. And it made the news and that kind of thing. And so this is in the 2000s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is in the 2000s.
I didn't know about that one.
Yeah, so it's... So some of these beliefs do still exist, I think, in certain areas, maybe in some rural pockets and stuff like that. I think it's a testament to the power and impact of these beliefs on cultures. You know, I think the fact that you find beliefs in the undead in sort of various places and various times, I think it resonates with people. I think, you know, call it the, you know, collective unconscious or something like that. I think people have a natural kind of fear. They have a fear of death, and thus they have a fear of the dead. And people don't want the dead to harm them or make them dead as well. And I think that's how some of this sort of evolves. And I think that's why it sticks around.
So what do you think about how the people of the past, what do you think if they saw the vampires of Twilight, what do you think the reactions would be? Do you think they would be as scared?
I mean, the thing is they would not know that that's a vampire,
right? They'd be like,
you would say that's a vamp. Yeah. You'd say it's a vampire. They'd be like, no, it's not. That's not.
Right.
You know, I think, you know, in the folklore, you know, vampires, well, they weren't going to high school, for one thing. But they were something to be feared. They didn't sort of live normal lives or live lives like, you know, kind of with like this double personality or something like that. Like in movies and things, you think of vampires as, you know, that they're showing up to parties and stuff like that, and at night and they're hanging out and all that. And people just think they're kind of suave or cool and don't realize, you know, in folklore, people were they were frightened of vampires. They weren't alluring. No one wanted to, you know, go out on a date with a vampire or something like that. Right. They were quite scared of them. You know, they wouldn't have had fangs, and stuff like that. They would have been someone who has been in the ground. Vampires were often thought to smell bad, because they were decomposing. They might look bloated, as I said, and red in the face and that kind of thing. So the imagery would have been different for sure. So people, I think, of the past would not necessarily recognize our vampires today.
So do you think if the people of today would not admire the vampires of the past. That's why it's still popular, because of Hollywood has, you know, Interview with the Vampire, Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt type of. Do you think that that's why it's still popular today?
Yeah, the vampire of the past wouldn't resonate with people today. I don't think it would have. I think you could make a cool movie with kind of doing more of an accurate folkloric depiction of a vampire. I think that would be cool. I don't think there would be as much sort of enthusiasm and cultural impact, because the vampires in folklore, they would either be in their grave or they'd be out killing people or hurting them in some way.
Right.
And that's kind of it. They weren't who they were, you know what I mean? When they were alive, because oftentimes the belief was that the vampire was harming like their family members. Right. So these are people that, you know, who passed with, like, this was a loved family member who might have passed away. And now they think that this family member is causing illness or death in friends and other family. So the vampire sort of just takes on a different kind of aspect. You know, when someone was thought to be a vampire, they sort of had this compulsion, and they weren't able, there was no sort of like, sort of fun or enjoyable aspect to it, like would be portrayed in a movie today, where they're like, where they're out flying around or something like that. It was a different kind of thing for sure.
It's not necessarily in the title of your book, but like werewolves and vampires, were they kind of based off each other? Because there's a lot of similarities with vampires and werewolf.
Yeah. So actually the last chapter of my book, I talk about similarities and kind of overlaps between werewolves and witches and malevolent witches and vampires. Right. So they absolutely were. Well, for one thing, people thought that someone who was a werewolf in life would become a vampire in death. That was a belief. There was a belief, from Normandy where, they thought that a corpse would, turn into a wolf and erupt out of the ground. And in that case, you essentially have a vampire, but it's a wolf instead of a vampire, instead of a human. In folklore, vampires were thought to be able to turn into like dogs,
right?
And things that was common. So you have some overlap, there as well. So I think they were oftentimes, influencing each other. Even some of the terminology, like in Greece, the term for a vampire was a bricolacus, which I think some people have thought that term evolved from a term for, or was related to a term for werewolves as well. So you absolutely had these different kind of supernatural entities influencing each other and sort of evolving together.
And I know we don't hear much about here in America, at least, like you said, there's some people that want to live their life as a vampire. And mostly we talk about vampires, you know, during the Halloween season. But are there other countries still, like you were just saying in the 2000s, that seriously believe that vampires are real and still, you know, what is it? Salt around, the salt around the doors and the garlic. Sure, yeah. And is there still people in this world that still believe that vampires are real?
Well, I mean, I think from some of the research I did, like that news story and things like that, I think it does maybe still exist in some rural areas and stuff like that to a certain extent. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how much, you know, I think with, you know, sort of the popularization of vampires in movies and things like that, I think that notion is probably spread pretty far and wide. But you know, I think it does. There was one village where this was fairly recently. I forget when. There was like a mill that collapsed that was thought to, was traditionally home to some vampire. And so some of the people were like, oh, the vampire's he's gonna be out and about now and stuff like that. But it's sometimes hard to tell with some things, whether it's a genuine belief or people are just kind of saying it because like tourism or, you know, or things like that, you know what I mean? Like they might just be, maybe they're having fun with it. It's hard to know exactly. So I'm not sure how much it still exists in any particular place. I think if it does still exist, like in that one particular news article, it's probably more of a limited thing, or maybe, you know, more in rural areas where they've hung on closer to some traditions of the past.
Right. Well, do you have any other books coming out soon that people can look out for?
Not at the moment. I've got a few ideas in mind that I'm going to be working on potentially, but I do have a website called locationsoflore.com. And on that site, I talk about some different places I've gone and some of the folklore behind it with pictures and things. And some of them are some like the graves of supposed vampires that I've visited. So if people are interested, they can check those out.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you for being on Truth Be Told. It's always a pleasure to meet some new friends and hear some great stories and your research. That way I don't have to do it myself. but AP Sylvia, go to locationsoflore.com. That's LORE. And thank you. And hopefully if you have another book, please come back and visit us. And we'd appreciate to hear what you have.
Oh, I certainly will. Thank you so much, Tony. Really appreciate being here.
All right, everybody. This is Tony Sweet for Truth Be Told. Until next time, make sure you go to our website, truthbetoldworldwide.com. Check out our all of our podcasts on Apple, on Spotify, iHeartRadio.com, pretty much everywhere you can find a podcast. And also, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and share this show. We really appreciate it, because without you guys, it wouldn't be anything. All right, until next time, I'm Tony Sweet. See you next Friday.